It's Thursday, December 4th, 2008, and it's got to be 420 somewhere in the world. I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville. Produced and distributed by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C., this is your normal daily audio stash, the growing truth about cannabis. Welcome to the most popular podcast regarding marijuana in all of America and all the world, featuring interviews with scientists, politicians, doctors, prohibition policy activists, regular cannabis consumers, musicians, and Normal's staff and Normal's board of directors, along with music and comedy no other podcast can offer. You can always find out more about our show at our website, stash.normal.org. and continue the education and conversation on our blog as well. We're ending marijuana prohibition with education, one listener at a time. The podcasting and blogging technology for the Normal Daily Audio Stash is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. For your professional web design needs, visit redaphid.com. Good day, Stashers, and welcome to the podcast. Say, if you're looking for a special holiday gift for that member of the cannabis community on your shopping list, check out Normal's online shop at Cafe Press. You can find it on the web at cafepress.com/NORML. All your purchases benefit Normal, helping to end adult marijuana prohibition. So check us out at cafepress.com/NORML. Now today on the podcast, we are featuring a presentation from Dr. Donald Abrams of the UC San Francisco Medical School from the Marijuana and Health Panel at the Normal National Conference in October. This panel was moderated by Dr. Mitch Earlywine. You may recognize Dr. Abrams from the recent Marijuana Nation documentary that premiered this week on the National Geographic Channel. Speaking of that documentary, we've been taking a poll out at our blog at stash.normal.org to find out what you thought of Lisa Ling's Marijuana Nation documentary. 41% of you said you haven't seen the documentary, while 24% said it was okay, somewhat inaccurate, but overall it was good. 21% of you liked it, saying it was not bad for a mainstream documentary. 11% of you loved it, saying it was a very fair look at the cannabis issue. 4% of you say you didn't like it, that it was another typical anti-drug documentary, but nobody said that they hated it, so I suppose that's pretty good for a marijuana documentary. Check out all the polls that we'll have up online at stash.normal.org. Also on the podcast today, we've got our regular Thursday visit with our 420 comedy correspondent down in Hollywood, California, Terry Joyce. Plus, we've got our hemp headlines and our musical break. So it's everything you've come to expect from the growing truth about cannabis, right here at your Normal Daily Audio Stash.
Hello, I'm Paul Stanford from the Hemp and Cannabis Foundation, or THCF. Medical marijuana is legal in 13 states today, and THCF has clinics in 8 of those states. Our doctors help qualified patients obtain an authorization for medical marijuana in their state. Patients are eligible for medical marijuana with a history of either severe chronic pain and or nausea, cancer, AIDS or HIV, hepatitis, glaucoma, seizure disorders like epilepsy, chronic muscle spasms such as multiple sclerosis or asthma, neurodegenerative diseases such as Alzheimer's, and gastrointestinal disorders like IBS or Crohn's disease. If you or someone you know has one of these conditions, our doctors will help you obtain a permit for medical marijuana. THCF Medical Clinics has offices in Washington State, Oregon, California, Colorado, Hawaii, Nevada, Montana, and now Michigan. Call 1-800-723-0188 or go to the web at hemp.org or 1-800-723-0188.
Now it's time to take a look at the latest stories about marijuana from news organizations across America and around the world in our Normal Daily Audio Stash, Hemp Headlines. Headlines. Michigan patients may be arrested until April? From FoxNews.com, Detroit, Michigan. Medical marijuana became legal in Michigan on Thursday, but smoking a joint could still get patients arrested because the regulations needed to protect them won't be ready for months. The law, approved by voters in November, allows patients with cancer, HIV, AIDS, glaucoma, and other diseases to use marijuana to relieve their symptoms on a doctor's recommendation. Qualifying patients can register with the state and receive ID cards allowing them to legally acquire, possess, grow, transport, and use a limited amount, no more than 2.5 ounces and 12 plants, of marijuana. They also can designate a primary caregiver to receive similar protection. But those cards won't be issued until the Department of Community Health introduces guidelines addressing how applications will be handled, what fees will be charged, and other issues. The rules must be finalized by April 4th. Until then, anyone possessing marijuana, even patients who could later qualify for the program, can be arrested and prosecuted, though the law allows patients to use a medical justification defense at trial. Some in law enforcement in Michigan are saying that they will go ahead and arrest the patients they catch with marijuana and then let the prosecutors decide if they wish to file charges. Why would you want to harass and burden these sick and disabled people when every single county in the state voted to protect them from harassment from law enforcement? Fox News three-part series on Clarence Aaron case. Three life sentences without parole. That's how long Calvin Smith, part of the notorious Murder, Inc. drug gang which terrorized Washington, D.C. in the 1990s, will be in jail for the cold-blooded murder of three people and for dealing drugs. It's how long Eric John Lawrence will be in jail for three holiday season armed robberies and a shooting in Houston in 2007. It's how long high school shooter Michael Carneal will be in jail for murdering three girls and injuring five other students while they were standing with their youth prayer group outside Heath High School in Kentucky in 1997. Three life sentences without parole is also how long Clarence Aaron will be in jail, because he introduced two drug dealers so that one could buy cocaine from the other. Aaron got $1,500 for introducing the dealers. In January of 1993, after discovering that his apartment in Baton Rouge had been searched by the FBI, Aaron turned himself in and was charged with conspiracy to possess a controlled substance with the intent to distribute, possession of a controlled substance with the intent to distribute, and attempt to possess a controlled substance with intent to distribute. He was released on bond and passed random drug tests for almost 8 months. He went on trial in August and was convicted on the three charges, possession, conspiracy, and attempted possession, with the intent to distribute 24 kilos of crack cocaine. That was 15 years ago when Aaron was 24. He has been in prison ever since. He's 39 years old now, and he will die in prison. Aaron's five co-conspirators, including the drug ring's kingpin, Watts, were arrested before him and cut deals with federal prosecutors to testify against Aaron in exchange for reduced sentences. On average, Aaron's co-conspirators, career drug dealers who knew better how to work the system, will spend about 8 years in prison. But Clarence Aaron, once a high school and college football player, a church-going member of the Masons, will grow old and die behind bars. I think the most maddening thing about the Clarence Aaron story is the fact that there were never any drugs found. This 24 kilos of crack cocaine never existed. Nobody ever proved it existed or that was ever traded or sold between anybody, much less Clarence Aaron. The drug dealers who were testifying against Aaron testified that there was 24 kilos involved, even though no one could prove it ever really existed. Clarence Aaron is the legacy of Vice President-elect Joe Biden's sponsorship of mandatory minimum sentencing legislation in the 80s. If anyone deserves a presidential pardon from George Bush or Barack Obama, it is Clarence Aaron.
Marijuana is an addictive drug which produces in its users insanity, criminality, and death.
Marijuana is the most violence-causing drug in the history of mankind.
If the hideous monster Frankenstein came face to face with the monster of marijuana, he would drop dead from fright.
Los Angeles Times columnist's wrong answer on should we tax pot?
Now, as we're desperately trying to reinvent the economy, should we consider marijuana? We've dipped a toe in those waters already in California. Sales of medical marijuana are taxable, $11.4 million worth for 2005 through 2006, the most recent figures available. Marijuana is a huge component of the nation's underground economy. A couple of years ago, the Legalize It forces estimated that the U.S. marijuana crop was worth $35 billion a year. California's share of that was $13.8 billion. If the number is even half that, any tax windfall on top of money saved by not prosecuting marijuana crimes would mean a bonanza, wouldn't it? Sacramento would be doing the backstroke in black ink. With all the new parks and health clinics, we'd have more ribbon cuttings than a baby shower. Is this just a pipe dream? Rosalie Pacula says that in all likelihood, yes. She's a senior economist at the RAND Corporation and co-director of its Drug Policy Research Center. Here's how she burst my bubble. First, you have to consider that legalizing it would have its own costs. Recent research, Pacula says, shows marijuana to be more addictive than was thought. Because marijuana is illegal, and because its users often smoke tobacco or use other drugs, teasing out marijuana's health effects and other associated costs is almost impossible. And more people would smoke it regularly if it were legal. Pacula estimates 60% to 70% of the population, as opposed to 20% to 30% now, and the social costs would rise. She also takes issue with figures from Harvard's Jeffrey Miron, among others, who says that billions spent on enforcing marijuana laws could all be saved by legalization. RAND's research, Pacula says, finds that many marijuana arrests are collateral, say, part of DUI checks or curfew arrests. And many arrestees already have criminal records, meaning they might wind up behind bars for something else, even if marijuana was legal. Legalization also wouldn't do away with pot-related crime entirely. There would likely be a black market, just as there is in other regulated substances, such as cigarettes and liquor. That means police and prosecution, which cost money. As to the tax benefit, that's partly a function of the price point for legalized pot. If everyone could legally grow and consume dope, then the crop probably wouldn't be worth $35 billion, and the taxes wouldn't be anything to write home about.
How many ways do you think we can debunk Pacula's premise, which seems to be that arresting 872,721 Americans for marijuana-related offenses and eradicating hundreds of millions of marijuana plants every year is cheaper than not legalizing marijuana? Did you find all seven? Check it out. Number one, marijuana is more addictive? Please. Increases in treatment admissions for marijuana addiction are due to increases of arrests for marijuana where pot smokers are sentenced to drug rehab. Pot is no more addictive now than it was in the 60s because THC is THC. The chemical has not changed. More potent marijuana does not make it more addictive. The effects are the same, just less pot is used. The National Institutes of Drug Abuse even rated marijuana as about as addictive as caffeine. Number two, there are plenty of marijuana users, like myself, who do not use tobacco or other drugs. I might drink one alcoholic beverage per month, on average, and I don't even use aspirin, acetaminophen, naproxen, nose spray, eye drops, or cold medicines. The National Survey on Drug Use and Health tells me that there were 19.8 million Americans who used some illicit drug in the past month. Of those, 14.4 million used marijuana. 9.2 million used drugs other than marijuana. Now, if I'm figuring this right, that means there are 3.8 million who use both marijuana and other drugs. Then there has to be 10.6 million monthly pot smokers who use no other drugs. Number three, 70% of the population would smoke pot if it were legal. Right now, the national surveys on drug use and health figures say that just 8% of the population use any illicit drug, with only 5.8% smoking pot monthly. 70% would smoke this more addictive legal pot when only 28.6% smoke highly addictive legal tobacco and 51.1% drink highly addictive legal alcohol. Number four, the social costs would rise. What are those costs? These nebulous assertions are often based on lost wages, productivity, crime, and healthcare costs that are associated with heroin, cocaine, or meth abuse. And then they end up lumping in marijuana as well under the umbrella term drug abuse. It's interesting to me that Pakula says it's tough to tease out the costs of marijuana because its users use other drugs, but then in the same paragraph claims legalizing only marijuana would cause social costs to rise. Number five, some marijuana arrests are collateral to other arrests, true. But most are collateral to what would normally be violations, like speeding, improper lane changes, or broken taillights. If some pot smokers might have been arrested anyway for curfew or DUI, then many more would have just gotten tickets instead of wasting a cop's time with an arrest and a booking. Besides, if marijuana arrests have tripled over the past 16 years, while both violent crime and property crime have declined, doesn't that mean that you've had to arrest more people for nothing but marijuana? Number six, there might indeed be a black market in marijuana when it is legal, just like the black market in cigarettes and liquor. A 2000 study says that 3-4% of tobacco sales are black market. Wouldn't the enforcement costs on tobacco be much higher if 100% of its sales were black market, like marijuana? And we can just look back to 75 years ago to determine whether the enforcement costs were higher on 100% black market sales of alcohol versus whatever small percentage of black market booze sales may exist today. Then you'd have to compare the enforcement costs on the few remaining black market marijuana sales against the economic benefits and the tax revenue that would be generated by the white market marijuana sales. And finally, seven, for the tax benefit, while everyone could legally grow their own, people like the writer and Rosalie Pakula have never actually tried to grow marijuana, and they must think you just drop a seed in some soil and forget about it. People are allowed to brew their own beer, too, but they seem to be willing to buy beer commercially and pay higher than normal taxes on it. Growing quality marijuana is a lot harder than home brewing beer. Marijuana's value in a legal market might be less without the risk costs of prohibition, but it won't be worthless either. Suppose the price of an ounce dropped to 20% of current prices, say from $300 an ounce to $60 an ounce. Even at just 20% of its current projected $35 billion in value, it would still be worth as much as wheat in this country. And the taxes on wheat are something we could write home about, huh?
Hello, Chicago!
Barack Obama has been elected the 44th President of the United States. But will he bring us, the cannabis community,
the change we can believe in?
It's an issue of doctors prescribing medical marijuana. I think that should be appropriate.
Normal is asking you to take action and help us hold President-elect Obama to his word with our $10,000 pro-cannabis law reform ad contest.
When I was a kid, I inhaled frequently. That was the point.
Just make a 30 or 60 second video or flash animation that answers the question, what should President Obama do about pot? You can submit as many entries as you like, and winning videos will be featured on Normal's website and television campaigns.
What I'm not going to be doing is using Justice Department resources to try to circumvent state laws on this issue.
The grand prize is $3,500, so enter early and enter often.
Well, I would not punish doctors if it's prescribed. That may require some changes in federal law.
Contest deadline is January 15, 2009. Check NORML.org for official contest rules.
The war on drugs has been an utter failure, and I think that we need to rethink and decriminalize our marijuana laws.
President Obama, we couldn't agree more.
Now it's time to take a look at 420 Comedy with the star of Hollyweed Live. You know her from the season one of Last Comic Standing on NBC. It's Terry Joyce. Well, we've made it through the Thanksgiving holidays and we're joined once again by Terry Joyce. Terry, welcome back to the show.
Thank you. How are you today?
I'm doing great. How was Thanksgiving for you this holiday season?
It was great. You know, I spent it with my dad and my family.
Aww.
And, you know, got a lot of turkey and good times. Yeah. And there was nothing traumatic that happened. Cause you know how, like, sometimes getting together with your family can be sheer hell.
Sure, sure. But we were talking before the interview here about the, California Supreme Court decision, People v. Mensch. And they decided that, in order to qualify as a caregiver under the Prop 215, you have to actually be giving someone care. You can't, just be giving them medical marijuana to qualify as a caregiver. So yeah, it was last week. Think what they're, the court case is really going to determine more about is the dispensaries that aren't being run as a patient caregiver collective. Now, Terry, you were telling me also that there was some recent raids on some dispensaries down there.
Yes, there's been a couple of dispensaries that have been raided, and the guy who ran them, his name is Patrick. I've met him before. Actually, ironically, we were both in the raid together when we were up at in the valley, when the Co Valley co-op. When I was in the raid, he was in the raid too.
Oh, okay.
And he has a couple of dispensaries, and they were raided yesterday. But he goes under the philosophy that he's using marijuana as a religious sacrament for religious purposes. And I think that's maybe why he might have been targeted.
Mm.
Because you know, our government's not acknowledging that philosophy. It happened, there was another dispensary, of course, you know, Temple 420.
Right.
That was, raided. And, the comedian, Craig X.
Yes.
Was trying to do the same thing and he got busted. So, they're trying really hard to get everybody, you know, here. Well, we know that what medical marijuana, what marijuana can do for you. I think we should just legalize it like we've legalized alcohol. I mean, it just needs to, you know, be taken off the class one drug classification, and it just needs to be made legal, and our government needs to tax it, and we just need to get. I mean, it's getting ridiculous now.
Tomorrow, December 5th. Is the 75th anniversary of the ratification of the 21st Amendment, which means that tomorrow, 75 years ago, is when alcohol prohibition ended. And so we're thinking, you know, let's celebrate the anniversary and end marijuana prohibition.
I mean, what we're talking about is marijuana prohibition, whether it's used medicinally or hemp's used for clothing. I'm sure the listeners know the history of how, you know, marijuana, became illegal. And there's a lot of dispensaries that they're put together by, when you sign on with a dispensary and they, you know, they find out that you, you know, you have the correct paperwork and that you are a medical marijuana patient, you become part of a co-op in a lot of the dispensaries. So that dispensary is your caregiver, is how it's done. Now, if you had a friend that was growing marijuana specifically for you and giving you that marijuana, that's perfectly legal under our law. It could be personal, or they branch out into like a co-op where they have so many people that they take care of.
Yeah, we agree. We're trying to start a initiative up here in Oregon to have the taxed and regulated sales of marijuana in a state-run store like we do liquor stores. We figure, you know, if we can trust adults to go out and buy Bacardi 151, can't we trust them to buy a bud?
Yes, and we can. Yeah. And, you know, and of course we know that you know, marijuana isn't as addictive as alcohol is. On a chart of addictions, you know, heroin's number one, and then it's, I think, cocaine, and then underneath that is alcohol, and then there's marijuana and caffeine.
Yeah.
Oh, tobacco's in there too, but I mean, those are, I mean, it's the least addictive. It's just slightly higher than caffeine.
Yeah.
And you know, of course, anybody can have an addiction to something. It doesn't necessarily even have to be drugs. But that's a whole different issue.
That's why we're here trying to end this war on adult marijuana consumers, because, you know, compared to what else we allow adults to do, you know, tobacco and alcohol, it makes no sense to ban people from using cannabis. It makes no sense.
It makes no sense. And especially when most people in this country have tried marijuana at one point in their lifetime. So this is a study between, I don't know, the ages of like 12 and 60 or however.
Terry, thanks again for joining us.
I smoke lots of weed, man. I plant that big old seed, man. I smoke every strain there is in town. From the super sticky green to the headache maxi brown, I smoke every strain there is around.
I know that I like it. I know that lots of people like it. So let's see what happens if you overdo it.
Do we have any pot smokers here today?
My name is Doug Benson, and I'm about to get super high.
The term medical marijuana, you drank the Kool-Aid, because there is no such thing as medical marijuana.
I'm going to smoke pot every day for 30 days and try to remember to film it.
And my movie's going to be called Super High Me.
Or Business as Usual. I haven't decided yet on the title.
I'm going to be hospitalized, I think.
Some people call it dope. Some think it smells like burning rope. I tell you, it relieves my mind.
Here at the Normal Daily Audio Stash, we work hard to change our nation's marijuana laws through education and discussion. But we also take time to relax and unwind with an eclectic mix of pod-safe music from many independent artists. We look for music that speaks to the growing truth about cannabis, or music that speaks to broader themes of freedom, liberty, social justice, equality, and protest. To find out more about the artists and download the music you hear on this podcast, just log on to stash.normal.org. And if you'd like to get your music heard by the online cannabis community, just send us an email at stash@normal.org.
Today's Stash music comes all the way from the United Kingdom. Blimey, chip chip cheerio and all that. What? Bangers and mash and steak and kidney pie. India is a country in... Okay, I'll stop. Robin Tim hails from Ashbourne and describes himself as an enthusiastic songwriter, reluctant performer, which right now sounds a lot like me, so I can identify. He has a definite singer-songwriter vibe, and his voice kind of sounds like David Gray. This song, Freedom, is about going to jail and all the things he's going to lose because of it, including his music and his liberties. Sound familiar, Stashers? You can hear more of Robin's music on his MySpace page, his GarageBand page, or through music.podshow.com. All of these links you can find on our blog at stash.normal.org. And without further ado, here is Robin Tim with Freedom.
It's been
undecided. It might seem a touch misguided, but tomorrow I am turning myself in. I've seen it coming, I have dreamed that I start running. Time to face the consequences of my sins. Take my guitars, cause I won't need them. Last day of freedom, I'm going back to jail. And keep my songs, I'll never sing them. They don't mean a thing when you're in a prison cell. Sentence, but refuse to show repentance. So my liberty is payment for my crimes. Made my reservation, I'll accept incarceration, where the only thing I can escape is time. Take my guitars, cause I won't need them. Last day of freedom, I'm going back to jail. And keep my songs, I'll never sing them. They don't mean a thing when you're in a prison cell. For plain concrete walls and a bolted metal door could never hold me, even if I
no longer support arresting and jailing marijuana smokers, and nearly as many support the medical patients having access to medical marijuana, and over 80% of our citizens now believe the war on drugs is an ineffective failure. So the question is, when will the government's misguided war on adult marijuana smokers finally end? When? Simple. When you and your like-minded friends, family, and co-workers get involved with an organization such as the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws, also known as NORMA. My name is Keith Stropp, and I founded the organization in 1970. Contact us at NORMAL, toll-free, 888-67-NORML, or by visiting the organization's up-to-date webpage at www.normal.org.
I'm going to begin with a man who essentially needs no introduction in this crowd, but I just want to say he's clearly the cutting edge of medical marijuana researchers and an inspiration to us all. Let's give a warm, normal welcome to Dr. Donald Abram.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here, and I welcome all of you, and particularly all my panelists who are not Northern Californians. As the local Northern Californian, I welcome you to Indian Summit in Northern California, and the weather that we get in October is one of the reasons that we choose to live here. There are many others. as you know. So for those of you that don't know me, I just wanted to go back and give you a little bit of my history of involvement in this challenging field in medical research. I owe my place at the podium to two of my friends, Mary Rathbun and Rick Doblin.
Yeah.
Mary, who you may recall, otherwise known as Brownie Mary, was the volunteer of the year at our AIDS clinic at San Francisco General Hospital for 2 years in the early 1990s. Mary used to wheel patients to x-ray and take their prescriptions from the pharmacy, and she used to bake them brownies, hence she was known as Brownie Mary. She baked these brownies for her kids, and at that time, in HIV, it was very disturbing. We had no treatments, patients died, and Brownie Mary's contributions were really legion. And I happened to be at the International AIDS Conference in Amsterdam, of all places, in 1992, and I glanced at CNN headline news and saw Brownie Mary being arrested in Sonoma for making marijuana brownies. And when I came back to San Francisco General, there was a letter from Rick Doblin, the founding president of MAPS, the Multidisciplinary Association for Psychedelic Studies, suggesting that a clinical trial demonstrating the medicinal benefits of cannabis come from Brownie Mary's institution, as if she were our dean. Well, in the early 1990s, there wasn't much going on in HIV research, which is what I was focusing on. So I picked up the gauntlet and began to try to do a clinical trial looking at cannabis in patients with the so-called HIV wasting syndrome, which was a very big problem in the early 90s in the Bay Area. Patients just became skeletal, looked like concentration camp victims, lost their appetite, and found benefit from smoking marijuana. At that time, and this was, remember, 92, we still had Bush 1. We were just transitioning to Clinton. We thought everything would be much better. Bush 1 closed the compassionate use program that was distributing cannabis for medicinal purposes to a handful of patients. And in the same year, 1992, dronabinol, or Marinol, synthetic delta-9 THC, became available as a treatment for loss of appetite associated with the AIDS wasting syndrome. So everybody said, well, patients don't need marijuana because we have dronabinol or Marinol. Now, when you take the one active component out of a plant that has 400 other things that balances the yin and yang, you're sort of, it's the Western pharmaceutically dominated paradigm that a plant is not a medicine, and that if we find the active agent, it's better. But the other agents in the plant are balancing the adverse effects of delta-9 THC. So, you know, that's one of the things I've learned in this 16 years that I've been doing this research. And in any event, it was, as one could imagine, quite difficult in the early 90s to get the government to allow me to do an investigation on the medicinal benefits of smoked cannabis. And I finally learned from Alan Leshner, who at that time was the director of NIDA, that NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, has a congressional mandate that they can only supply marijuana for clinical trials that look at it as a substance of abuse. He said, Donald, we are the National Institute on Drug Abuse, not for drug abuse. So we cannot study marijuana as a treatment for a medical condition. So in 1997, we received our first grant from the government to study cannabis in patients with HIV taking the very potent new antiretroviral medicines, the protease inhibitors. These drugs are metabolized by the kidney, or by the liver, through the same system that metabolizes a number of other drugs and recreational substances. And there had been a case of a person dying from an overdose of ecstasy who was taking these protease inhibitors. So we wrote a clinical trial looking at the safety of smoked cannabis in patients taking these new potent HIV protease inhibitors. And the government liked that because we're looking at safety and potential toxicity. We weren't looking for effectiveness. And we did get an award of $1 million and received 1,400 of the government's finest cannabis cigarettes in 1997. And over the next few years, we conducted a clinical trial where we enrolled 67 people. For 25 days each, they were basically incarcerated in our general clinical research center at San Francisco General Hospital. And we measured the impact of smoking cannabis 3 times a day, taking dronabinol 3 times a day, or dronabinol placebo, on the level of virus in their bloodstream, the measurement of the protease inhibitors in their bloodstream and on their immune system. And we found basically that there was no detrimental effect on the virus, on the levels of protease inhibitors, and in fact there may have been a suggestion that there was improvement in the immune system, something that was quite surprising to everyone. So with that information that cannabis was safe, we were then fortunate to be here in California, where in those years of budget surplus, one of our heroes, State Senator John Vasconcellos, introduced a bill in the legislature that created the University of California Center for Medicinal Cannabis Research. This center's goal really was to investigate the potential medical effectiveness of cannabis in a number of conditions. And they had $3 million a year for 3 years to fund clinical trials. And NIDA worked it out. So as long as they weren't funding the studies, being the only legal source of cannabis for research, they would provide cannabis to studies that were otherwise funded. So the CMCR graciously funded my group to do 4 clinical trials. I just want to say that the 2 studies that we were funded to do in cancer patients both failed because we could not enroll cancer patients in cannabis studies. I'm an oncologist, and for me, this is really quite startling and disturbing, and I'll get back to that towards the end of my short remarks here. But the studies that we were able to do, I think, were the 2 studies that we completed have both been published last year, and I'm sort of proud of them. The first was a clinical trial in patients with HIV-related painful peripheral neuropathy. This is nerve damage, similar to what diabetics get, similar also to what cancer patients get from chemotherapy. And it's painful numbness and tingling of the fingers and toes, for which opioids don't work, non-steroidals don't work, acupunctures. So and most people are treated now with an anti-seizure medicine called gabapentin, or Neurontin. And we did a clinical trial, first a small pilot study where everybody smoked the active cannabis, and then we were bold and blazing enough to do a placebo-controlled trial where we randomized patients to smoke either real cannabis or placebo cannabis that came from NIDA. It smells and looks just like their normal rolled-up cigarettes in the Pall Mall papers, but they've extracted the active substance, the cannabinoids, from the product that's rolled inside the papers. And, you know, much to everybody's surprise, we clearly demonstrated that there was twice as good a response to smoking real cannabis than placebo in both the neuropathic pain and an experimental pain model that we created. We knew that people were going to say, oh, gee, you got a lot of people here who are advocates for medicalization of marijuana, and they're going to not really double-blinded because the people smoking cannabis are probably going to know they're smoking cannabis. So, you know, you're skewing them. So we did this experimental pain model where we heated skin to 104 degrees and then rubbed capsaicin cream, which is the active ingredient in chili peppers, on that spot. And we measured the area of abnormal feeling around the spot after smoking cannabis. And that sort of is an experimental model for pain. And the results of that correlated exactly with the results of our neuropathic pain evaluation. So this was the first study. You know, the people that say, well, we can't, you know, there's no accepted medical use. So this is a study that had proved that marijuana had an accepted medical use. And you would think that the New England Journal or Lancet or the Journal of the American Medical Association would be interested in publishing it, but not. That's another problem that I've really appreciated in trying to do research in medical marijuana, that, you know, even when you do a rather elegant, refined clinical trial, it's very difficult to get it published. But it was published in the premier journal of neurologists, the journal called Neurology. And it, I think it was an important paper, and it came out on Valentine's Day in 2007. The other study that we successfully did with CMCR funding, I think it's important with regards to Ethan's comments, we took 25 to 40-year-old healthy marijuana smokers. This is the easiest study I've ever enrolled. And we put them in our General Clinical Research Center for 6 days, and on each day they either smoked or vaporized half of a NIDA cigarette. and the nine cigarettes were 1.7% THC, 3.4 and 6.8. I must say that I feel responsible after my first clinical trial telling NIDA, gee, you need more potent marijuana. And they said, well, we can't really make it because it's too sticky to be rolled in our machines. I said, well, then roll it by hand. You need more potent marijuana. So finally, they did come up with a 6.8% potency. And in our study, we compared smoking half of a cigarette to vaporizing it in the volcano vaporizer. And we found that the level of THC in the bloodstream was equivalent. There was much less expired carbon monoxide, which is a marker for noxious gases. And the patients actually had a preference for the vaporization. And that could be because NIDA cigarettes are freeze-dried and we have to rehydrate them. They're a little harsh. We also measured the high. And the Nature Medicine Journal that finally published this, one of the reviewers said, how did you document, or what's the gold standard for the high? How did you validate that? You know, how do you validate how high somebody is? There's not sort of a, you can't plug them in and measure it. I answered that reviewer's comment with my tongue in cheek the whole time. So that study we did, and that was published, and that led to my belief that one thing that we really needed to do now is look at the interaction between cannabinoids and opioids. So now we're in the process of completing, and we still need six more people, and that's why I've left these leaflets out on tables throughout the hotel here. This is a study, again, funded by NIDA, the National Institute on Drug Abuse, because we're not looking for the benefit of adding cannabis to opioids. We're looking for the safety. And basically, we're doing a study very similar to what we did with protease inhibitors, where we're having patients who are on a stable dose of morphine or OxyContin, taken twice a day, because that's how those drugs are supposed to be given, come into our General Clinical Research Center and vaporize cannabis for 5 days, measuring the levels of the opioid in their bloodstream before and after exposure to the cannabis. The belief being that cannabis will increase the benefit of the opioids in relief of pain and allow people to take opioids at lower dosages for longer periods of time. This study, again, funded by NIDA, we're running out of our funds in January, we still need six more people, has been very difficult to enroll. Number one, I started it as a study for cancer patients because I'm a cancer doctor. And cancer patients just are not knocking the door down to be in our clinical trials. I think if they want marijuana, they get it. And if they don't want marijuana, they don't want it. So that's different from HIV patients who seem to be more committed, perhaps to the movement, et cetera. Cancer patients are dealing with their own malignant disease and don't feel a need to, you know, really participate in these trials. So we opened it to any patient with any pain. MAPS, MPP, everybody, Greg here, everybody's been very helpful in getting patients into the study. MAPS is paying for airfare for people to come from around the country. We still have not enrolled them. Part of the problem is that most people take their opioids three times a day, and we're measuring the kinetics in patients who take it twice a day, so that's one problem. Otherwise, you know, I don't know why we're having such a difficult time, and it makes me, this is my last cannabis clinical trial that I'm funded to do. I want another study. I want you to help me figure out what we should do next. But, you know, it's a little bit frustrating when it's so difficult to enroll patients into clinical trials. And again, I just want to conclude by saying what I do now is what I call integrative oncology, where I see cancer patients and I talk to them about how to integrate nutrition, exercise, botanicals, guided imagery, Chinese medicine into their conventional care. I do this at the UCSF Osher Center for Integrative Medicine, and I'd say one out of two patients that I see, I'm writing them a letter because they have never discussed use of cannabis with their conventional oncologists. As a cancer specialist, I have one drug that can decrease nausea, increase appetite. None of our other antiemetic drugs also increase appetite. Decrease pain, and I know from the clinical trial that I'm doing, even though I'm not measuring pain relief, that patients on an opioid who smoke or vaporize cannabis do get increased pain relief. Help people sleep, and in fact, in some cases, also aid with depression. This is one drug. I write a lot of letters. Unfortunately, under the law, I cannot tell people where to get it. So that's really silly. I do want to conclude by saying that I think we'll make another step forward. I have edited a textbook with Andrew Weil on integrative oncology that's being published. The first copies are going to be out next month for our Society for Integrative Oncology meeting, and in March it'll be for the general public. I thought it was an academic text, but Oxford University Press is selling it for $35 for 600 pages. Andrew wrote the first chapter. We had 30 other authors, and the chapter I wrote, chapter 7, is cannabinoids and cancer. And I wrote it with Manuel Guzman, who's a professor from Complutense University in Madrid, who studies cannabis as an anti-cancer agent. So not only is this a medicine that helps people with symptomatic relief of cancer, but in fact in the future we may find out that it has benefits in protecting and treating cancer as well. With that, I just want to finish and allow comments from our fellow panelists, and I guess we'll be back for questions later. Thank you.
Thank you for downloading the Normal Daily Audio Stash, The Growing Truth About Cannabis. We are produced by the National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws in Washington, D.C. Our executive producer is Alan St. Pierre. Our deputy director is Paul Armentano. Our webmaster is Brian Judy. And web production is provided by Red Aphid Interactive Media. As always, you can catch up on the latest information about marijuana at www.norml.org. And you can interact and download from our Audio Stash blog at stash.normal.org. For everyone here at Normal, I'm your host, Radical Russ Belville, hoping all your harvests are bountiful and your encounters with law enforcement are non-existent.